Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. I don't know about you, but when I break something, my first instinct is to toss it and buy a new one. That is not how it worked back in the old days. Back on Little House on the Prairie, they knew how to fix stuff. Maybe you could fix that stuff with a little bit of help. Community repair cafes are popping up all over the world, and they allow users to fix some of these broken things while saving some cash. We're going to learn more about Repair Cafe Toronto from its co-founder, Paul Madger. Then, the customer's always right. Right? If only that were really true, Ellen Roseman would have nothing to write about. Roseman is a financial journalist and longtime consumer advocate with a regular column in the Toronto Star. The reality is that the customer isn't always right, of course. She's going to be here to talk about lessons she has learned in fighting for consumer rights. And what would you give up to get rid of your debt? Coffee, fancy dinners out, a kidney, a finger. According to a new report from Ipsos and MNP, 85% of Canadians said they'd be willing to make some sort of personal sacrifice to have their debt disappear. We'll look at the report with Ipsos Vice President of Public Affairs, Sean Simpson. Plus, legacy planning. Not being prepared if someone were to unexpectedly pass can cost your loved ones not only stress, but also money. We're going to learn how digital legacy planning system Future File could help. All that's ahead. Let's get started. A vacuum cleaner, a laptop, a blender, a lamp, a dining room chair, all broken. It sounds like a pile of junk you just throw out, but maybe, just maybe, you could fix it with some help. Repair cafes are a network of meetup places that encourage people to fix their broken stuff to benefit the environment and save money. Joining us now to tell us more is Paul Magder. He is co-founder of Repair Cafe Toronto. Hello there.
Hi.
Where did the idea for Repair Cafe Toronto come from?
Well, it was kind of a family affair. My wife and I were at a family event, and we were talking to a cousin of hers about maker spaces and sustainability and the environment. And she had heard of Repair Cafe Amsterdam, which
right.
is where it started. And we just started talking about how...
How would we do that here?
Yeah.
So how does it work?
The event is basically we travel around the city with these big events once a month where we have about 50 volunteers now, 40 or 50. In a four-hour period, we get over 100 people coming, and they bring their broken items. We have a registration process because we want to track what people are bringing and if they got fixed. And because it's fairly big, we have areas, different areas for different things. So we have an area for household items, an area for jewelry and clothing. But we do bookbinding, small furniture, computers. And we hook up the people with the right fixer, and they sit together. So it's totally free. But you have to participate.
See, this is why I would be bad. I would ask the person for help, and then I just sort of like slide away and watch them do the work themselves.
Well, no, it's fine. If you don't want to actually get hands-on, we don't force people to do anything.
Yeah, but it's kind of the point, isn't it, to be involved in them?
Well, at least they have to see what's going on, because our fixers are very, like, they like to explain as they're doing everything.
Right.
You know?
What's the target market here? I wonder if I'm the wrong temperament. And I ask because years ago I seized a lawnmower, like a long, long time ago.
Uh-huh.
So I registered in a small engine repair class
and
took 3 months repairing this small engine, sanding it, filing down the piston. And I was very satisfied with the accomplishment of having a working lawnmower again, but I vowed in that moment to hire a mechanic for every other mechanical challenge for the rest of my life because it was that much work.
Yeah.
What kind of temperament does this attract?
Well, a lot of times it's people who love the item that they're bringing.
There's sentimental value.
Yeah, they don't want to. It's been broken. Sometimes they've been in their basement for 2 years, and then they hear about us and they bring it to see if it can get going again. Other people are people who actually are handy but don't have the tools, or they don't have the knowledge, and they just want to – they know this can be fixed, or they're pretty sure, and they want someone to help them. So there's the two kinds of things. Then there's the people who want to save the environment. They don't want to throw something out.
Yeah.
They just don't think it's right. And so they're coming to to do that, and then they meet each other people and so on.
I have this printer that will not print. Mm-hmm. It will scan, but it will not print. How do you figure out what can and cannot be repaired in the context of a repair cafe?
Well, a lot of it's trial and error, but then there's a lot of experience now that we've been going for 5 years almost. So a lot of our fixers have got, like printers, for example, are not easy things to fix, actually. Yeah. They're quite difficult. So, but there's a whole troubleshooting process that you go through if it's something like that. Where you go step by step. First, does the power work? Is there
right.
Does the switch work and so on?
We live in a disposable culture, certainly mm-hmm. now versus days of yore. Is it hard to get people to think differently about that?
Yes, it is actually. The people who come to us are kind of already thinking differently. Like they're not,
right.
They don't want to be part
They wouldn't
of that.
Waste the time and show up with mm-hmm. their item if they didn't think
But
that.
It's difficult to... You know, when you bring something that's broken, like if you tried to get it fixed by a professional, they would say it's not worth it because it isn't for them to spend 5 hours fixing a toaster when another, you can buy one for $40 or, you know, I try to tell people don't buy cheap because you're going to end up throwing it out sooner and you can't fix these things. But anyway, that's, it's hard to get people to.
How has technology changed what can and cannot be repaired? And I ask because you look at one of those old slow cookers and you could see, oh, it's probably just a faulty wire or something like that. But you look at a modern Instant Pot with its NASA-level control panel. If that were to go on the fritz, I can't imagine anyone being able to fix that.
Yeah, actually, I just had that the other day trying to fix a bread maker. Everything works on it except for the electronics.
Huh.
And you can't replace that.
How do you factor in parts? Some stuff needs parts.
Well, we try. We don't always have all. We have some parts, but we can explain to the person what part they need, how to replace it, and where to get it. That's the protocol. But we do have a lot of common fuses and switches and things.
Is there a social element for people be a part of this?
Definitely. We have people.
Is it licensed?
We have like people who follow us all over the city because every month.
It's not licensed, is it? You just skipped over that question.
No.
It's not licensed. Ugh.
Licensed but there are
people,
for what?
For booze.
Oh.
Very people doing shots. You get to do a drink every time you fix a. I don't even know.
No, we have a bell. We ring a bell.
Yeah. A bell. That's good. That's almost as good as a shot. For volunteer fixers, are they repair professionals or people who just want to help other people out?
It's a mixture. Some are professionals, computer people, or people in different industries. Many are retired professionals.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are just handy people who are handy around the house, or sewers, people who the bookbinder is his profession is nothing related to that.
Our show airs all across Canada and parts of North America too. What advice would you have for someone who hears this interview and says, I should found one of those in my community? What's the first thing they should do?
Well, the first thing they should do is start talking to their friends and neighbors in their community and find people who like to fix things and then find a location. And it doesn't have to be a big deal. It can just be...
What does it need to have, the location?
It just needs a space,
power,
tables and chairs and power.
And a bell. Can you bring the bell?
Yes, you can bring
the bell. You can bring the bell. Good to know. Paul, thank you for coming in today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Magner is one of the co-founders of Repair Cafes Toronto.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Passing on good money habits to the next generation is really, really important. By starting kids on an allowance early, parents can change the way they have conversations about money with their kids. Rooster Money is an allowance tracking app that helps parents teach their kids good money habits. James Kassam's with Rooster Money. He's in London, England.
Hi, Bruce.
I have a 7-year-old, so I have skin in this game here. Tell us how Rooster Money works exactly.
Okay. So Rooster Money is a pocket money and allowance tracking app, and it's all designed to help parents teach their kids about money in our current digital age, in our current cashless society. And we ultimately set out to answer a simple question, which is, how do I, as a parent, yourself, teach your kids the values of money in the digital world? So what we do is try and promote those conversations, positive conversations about money, as early as possible in life. And we use the app to eliminate all the barriers one might typically have with an old method pocket money routine to free up those conversations to happen. So in essence, parents will sign up their kids from as young as, we've got kids on it as young as 3 or 4 years old, and then they will set them up with either a regular allowance or ad hoc rewards, say, done the washing or they've been good for the day. And once the money's in there, the kids can then go in and start to manage that money. So that could mean they decide to spend it. They could put it towards certain savings goals. And then they work with that money so that they understand then the basic principles of money. And it gives a platform for the parent to have those conversations about money, whether that's around needs and wants, or whether that's around the value of saving, or do you really need to spend that? So that's the basics of what we're trying to achieve here.
So when you download it to your device, whatever device that is, it's something that both the parents and the kids interact with. Tell us what it looks like. This is radio, so we got no pictures.
Yes. Okay, so yes, absolutely. The parents and the kids both use the app. They have separate logins, which is key, so that the kids can't add money themselves.
Yes.
But for the parent, which is a common problem. But so for the parent, let's say you have more than one kid, you enter the app and you will have your parent dashboard, as we call it, which will have a picture of each of your kids and will show you how much each of them has in their wallet. And then when a kid logs in, they will see their own account, and it's separated into a spending area, which we call the wallet, a saving area, which we call the safe, and goals, where kids can go in and set their own goals up, whether that's a Lego Death Star or a new pair of trainers. So they have pots, as it were. And we're actually about to launch a new pot, which is the giving pot or the donation pot, so that parents can teach their kids in whichever way they want, because for us, it's very important that we are a framework as opposed to a set solution. So once the money's in there, the parents can sit with their kids and discuss, right, you have, let's say, $6 a month, $6 a week. Do you want to be putting $1 to savings, $2 to your goal for that week? And that's broadly speaking how it works, how it looks. It's very simple, clean design, where you have your pot so you can visualize how much is in the spending, how much is in the saving, how much are in the goals.
And I assume when you say pot, you mean a container versus that word being used colloquially here in Canada refers to cannabis. So I'm assuming you're not talking about saving up for some ganja here, because that would be a whole different lesson entirely.
That is a different app entirely. Absolutely.
I'm so glad I clarified. I want to ask, so there are tons of allowance tracking apps out there. There's lots of stuff, some of it from the bank, some of it from the financial literacy folks. How would you say Rooster Money is different from what else is out there?
Sure. So we have, I think that the emphasis that we like to put on things which we think makes us different is really the education, especially at some of those younger years. So some apps are designed quite heavily towards utility to make it a lot easier for the parent and the kid to transact with that money and pay with that money. We see ourselves as we do that, but we also put a lot of emphasis on creating those conversations and creating those moments of conversation. So, for example, the fact that we're a tracking app where the money is virtual as opposed to you don't actually pay with the app at the moment of purchase, the kid still needs to go to the parent and say, Mom, Dad, please can I have that $5 to buy this magazine? And that creates a moment to have that conversation with the child. So we feel that we're all directed towards the education side of things before you really kick in with ease of payments and preparing them for the future. That's what we see our kind of point of difference there.
Some of the frequently asked questions that I get, I mean, I do a lot of work with parents in schools, and they want to know how to think about allowance versus chores. How do you have a recommendation on that?
Well, it's also one of the questions we get asked the most as well. And I think, you know, the first answer in a lot of this is that, you know, every family works differently and every family's been brought up with different principles. So, we have to respect that. I think the key thing for us is taking a step back from that and saying, set up a routine and stick to it. You know, so you may be the type of family that wants to say you only get your pocket money if you've done your chores. We find in those instances that works. But then also if you say, you know, a certain chore is worth 50 cents and another chore is worth a dollar, sometimes you get to the end of the week and the kids say, oh, I won't actually do the washing up today, Mum, because I've got my £5 and I'm happy with that. It really depends on the family. We wouldn't say one way works better than another. I think the main advice is just to set up a system, set up a routine and stick to it. And that's the way that the kids will learn best, is by kind of developing those habits. And that's another kind of area that we've tried to work on in the app, is design everything to create habits and build habits. And because I'm not sure if you're aware, but the Cambridge University over here did a bit of research with the Money Advice Service a couple of years ago, and they found that your adult money habits are actually set by the age of 7. Which is pretty scary when you think about it, and probably a lot earlier than a lot of us think, which is why, you know, we think it's really important to start early, and the app is designed so that kids of a younger age can use it and, importantly, find it fun as well. So, for example, it's not always money. You can set the currency in the app to be stars, at which point it becomes more like a typical star chart or reward chart. So you're still conveying those key habits of delayed gratification or understanding reward systems, for those families that don't necessarily feel like kids are ready to be talking about money just yet.
There are so many life lessons for our little ones to learn, and our young people and our teens too. But if you had to choose just one habit for them, what would the one habit be?
Which age group or kids in general?
Kids in general.
I would have to say it's talk about money, mainly with your parents. I think, you know, going back to studies again, you know, we can educate our kids in schools, we can educate them however we want, but at the end of the day, the parents are the biggest influence on the kids, and so ensuring you have those conversations is the key point. So for me, it would be talk about money, ask questions, have positive conversations about it.
James, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's been a pleasure.
James Kassam is with Rooster Money. He joined us from the UK. And you heard his call to action here. Talk to your kids about money, please. Coming up next on Moolala, Ellen Roseman has been fighting on behalf of consumers for decades. We'll look back on what she's learned fighting the good fight. And later, we'll look at a new survey from Ipsos and MNP that shows just how far Canadians would go to become debt-free. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Selry or on Facebook at Bruce Selry Moolala. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Selry on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Just this week, I got an email from someone who wrote a check that was cashed by someone who wasn't the recipient. Her bank basically left her to fight it out with the other bank herself. It's just so annoying. Sometimes consumers need help. Whether it's the banks going up against door-to-door salespeople, fighting back against telecom overbilling, consumers can really benefit from someone who has their back. For many, many of her readers over the years, Ellen Roseman has been that person, writing for the Toronto Star. She joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
You're kind of a legend. I said to my producer, Ellen Roseman's kind of a legend, in part because of your decades of service and in part because of the influence that you have. I want to start by asking you, though, how you got into the business side of the business beat, because you started out in women's wear, covering women's wear for Style magazine.
That was the only job I could get. The real influence for me, I didn't go to journalism school. I went to McGill, and I worked on the McGill Daily for 3 years in the days when it was a daily, Monday to Friday.
Wow.
And it was the late 60s. I'm dating myself, but we were so activist. We got kicked out for a while because we accused a McGill engineering professor of helping with the Vietnam War with his soil research. Student council got rid of us, and then we got reinstated again. So it was all about activism. And when I was looking for a job, I didn't have any journalism experience. So I got into the business side of things, and they asked me who was my big influence. I said, Ralph Nader. You know, that was the height of his fame. And then it was Beryl Plumtree, who was Canadian, who was appointed by Pierre Trudeau to study food prices in the days when inflation was 18 to 20%. And she came from the Consumers Association, and she was pretty tough. And I really admired her. And then Phil Edmonston from the Lemonade Card Guides. And
So the outlier was Style magazine. The outlier wasn't business. You've been doing this for a long time.
But way back when, I freelanced an article for Chatelaine magazine. It was called When Women Won the Fashion Revolution. This was in like 69 or 70.
Yeah.
Because they were wearing miniskirts, and everybody loved the miniskirts, but the fashion industry couldn't allow that to continue. So they brought out something called the maxi skirt, which was like almost down to your ankles. And everyone said, forget it, I'm not wearing that. And so maxi skirts flopped. And then soon after that, pants came in, and women could wear pants in the office, which was huge.
It's amazing historical context, right? Because we simply don't appreciate how far we have come. And so me as a guy, but for everybody, how far we have come in the generations or the decades that have passed. You were at the Globe and Mail for a long time. How did you get the consumer beat? Like where did that come from? Is that burning passion that you had back from Ralph Nader is my idol?
Yes, and also after the Women's Wear Daily, or the Style magazine, I was in the same building as the Financial Post. So I started freelancing for them. And I wrote about retailing and then more into consumer issues. So that's when I really got the feel for it. And in those days, the consumer movement was pretty strong, and they got a lot of government money. So the Consumers Association would have annual meetings. They'd have like 300 or 400 people. They had a magazine. They did testing. It was really the heyday. And the federal government was giving them a great deal of money. And the provincial governments were starting as well. And so from the Financial Post, I went to the Toronto Star because I met the guy who was writing for the Toronto Star on consumer issues, and he was leaving for the Globe. So I went to the Star right away, and I said, I want his job. And they said, but you don't have any daily experience. I gave them my two full scrapbooks of articles, clippings, and they read it, and they said, okay, we'll hire you. And then funny thing was, a year after I was at the Toronto Star first for a year. Then I went to the Globe for 20 years. And then I went back to the Toronto Star. So I've been back and forth a lot. And I followed the same fellow who left the Star for the Globe. And then he left the Globe. He retired. I think he had enough money.
How do you see your role as a consumer advocate? Because you're not a traditional journalist, in that you don't, you know, just sit there and just cover bank earnings and write those kinds of reports. You advocate for consumers.
Yes, it's changed a lot. At the beginning, I was writing a lot more about organized consumer groups, but they kind of fell apart. The Consumers Association had a lot of middle-class housewives who were at home with the kids, and they got very well-versed in insurance and baby seats and all that kind of thing. But then all of a sudden, women are in the workforce. Nobody had time for volunteer jobs. So the real game changer for me was the coming of email and the internet. Because I'd write a story about how Enbridge was having a big problem, their billing wasn't correct, there were a lot of people. I'd start with like one person and describe his story. I always feel that people relate to people really well. But then, like, I get emails from all kinds of other people saying, I have that exact same story. I thought I was reading my own story. Can you help me too? So email made it really simple. The Star, years ago before I got there, had something called Star Probe, which was an organized kind of – but what they did was they sent letters in the mail, and they waited for letters to come back in the mail. And at their peak, they had 7 people working there.
Wow.
And then they killed it in the 90s because it was too expensive. And then I started at the Star in 97, and I was business editor for 2 years, and then I went back to being a columnist. And I found that with email, it was so easy just to flip, you know, forward emails back and forth.
Yeah.
And that's when I started getting to know all the people that helped me out. And now when I send them emails, they're often, I'm sending them at 11 p.m. and they're responding at 11:30 p.m. It's quite different.
How do you determine what to tackle? You certainly could never tackle all of the complaints that you receive. I can't even imagine. How do you make the call?
I stick to larger companies. I want policy issues, customer service issues. The larger companies, those with familiar names, they have a brand to protect, so I have more traction with them. I'm not going to go after the little guy who goes door to door and paves your driveway and then sticks you with the bill. You've paid him all up front. The TV people love that because they can run after him and they can interview him. But I feel that that's not my role. So the bigger companies, I found, there's plenty of issues. You know, we have the banks, we have the telecom, we have the large retailers. There are so many issues. I never run out of material, and I've been doing this 20 years now.
You say that oftentimes people respond with you quite quickly. What's your process? How do you go about fighting a complaint on someone's behalf or developing the piece that you're in that will end up in the paper?
It starts usually with one person writing to me about something. I think of them as my kind of mystery shoppers,
right?
Because they're out there in the field. They know what's going on. And one person will write to me about something. So if it's one of my, I don't know, I've got about 20 or 40 different companies that I follow closely and I know all the people and who to send it to. So I'll send the one and then it's up to them to decide what to do with it. And sometimes they respond to me. Sometimes they just respond directly to the person. But if it's just a one-time occasion, I won't write about it. I wait until there's a critical mass of at least 5 or 6 different complaints. And then I'll go back to the company and say, look, there seems to be some kind of systemic issue here. That's what I'm always looking for. How do you respond to this? And a good example is my column today where I was writing about these phones that were sold by Google Play in Canada and manufactured by LG, and they're called the Nexus phones. And at first they were great, but sometime in the second year after the warranty's up, they went into something called boot loop, which is just an endless cycle of trying to restart and not being able to restart, booting again and again, and finally just the battery dies. And then the phone becomes a brick. So they were helping some people under the warranty. It turned out there was a class action in the U.S., and that's often the case that LG actually settled in the U.S. And they kind of informally said to people, we're going to fix it for free under an extended 24-month warranty. But a bunch of people found that when they went to Google or LG, they were told the a serial number of your phone or the IME number showed it was from the U.S.
Like an incredible level of detail you have to get into these sorts of things. What advice do you have for consumers in fighting their own fight? They don't have your reputation. They don't have the direct email of the, you know, the public affairs person at these big companies. What advice do you have for them?
I'd say start by writing an email or calling. But if you call, make sure to put down all the relevant information about who you're speaking to and tape it. You know, it's not against the law to tape, and you don't even have to ask. Just do it because they're always taping your call. And when you need their tape, you can't find it. So you don't get anywhere. Try and escalate it, get to the next level of the company. Sometimes they have that information on the internet about the different steps. But then when you get really frustrated, use social media. Twitter is often very good. Some companies ignore it, but other companies take it seriously. Go to the Facebook page of the company. They can delete you, and they often do, but make yourself a big pain in the neck and try and make sure that your complaint is justified, that you have some kind of expert testimony or clippings or photos or something to document it.
Do you have to manage your own emotions on this? Because I can imagine I could see myself getting very angry on behalf of the letter writers. And I don't know. Like, do you ever take it personally?
Sometimes, but after I've been doing this for a long time, I try and, you know, keep an even keel. I feel sorry for people for sure. And I don't try to call them anymore, partly because calls take a long time, but also sometimes they cry on the phone.
Oh,
that's hard. So, you know, I'll take their emails and I keep trying to encourage them. You know, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And sometimes it doesn't happen. But sometimes I'm reluctant to stop even when the company says no. I keep looking for other ways to get around it. And sometimes I'll manage to do that. But I have to be optimistic, even though I think that companies today get away with murder. And what bothers me is that they treat the media people like me with kid gloves. They're really, really nice. And they try as much as they can to give the customer the benefit of the doubt. But without me, they just grind them down and tell them, no, we can't allow it. Like Google would say, you've got a U.S. phone, even though it was sold in Canada, we can't touch it. And all these terms and conditions often written in tiny, tiny print. And so I have to keep saying, you know, if I get to the right person in the company, they're going to read this and they're going to say, poor person. But on the other hand, they're also going to say, how's this going to look in print? This isn't going to look so good.
Right. Thank you very much, Ellen. Appreciate you being here. Ellen Roseman is the consumer advocate for the Toronto Star. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take Ellen Roseman through the Moolala questionnaire. But next, legacy planning. Preparation for the inevitable passing of loved ones can save you money and also stress. We'll learn about a digital legacy planning system called FutureFile. I'm also the money columnist for CityLine, which is a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. You can check out some of those segments online at cityline.tv. Then search for me. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Of course, you can't really fully prepare for the loss of a loved one, but there are things you can do to minimize the stress and the financial burden associated with the unexpected. It is not a fun topic. It is not an easy topic to be thinking about, but being prepared can provide you with some peace of mind in the present and cut down on your stress in the future. We're going to look at a legacy planning system called FutureFile. Kel Roth is the founder. She joins us now from Chicago, Illinois. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I'm great. I really believe this is an important topic for us to be thinking about. My parents are in their early 80s. They are both full of vim and vigor, but I go to bed and sleep much better knowing that I have done a lot of prep for when they move to the other side, hopefully 20 or 30 years down the road. You have a great deal of passion for this, and part of it, I understand, comes from your personal experience after the death of your father. Tell us what he had done to prepare.
Yes, you know, it's interesting. You were very fortunate and blessed that your parents, have lived a full life. I did not get so lucky. I actually encountered four passings. I had a boyfriend who was killed in a car accident at age 21, and then my mom was diagnosed with leukemia a year later and passed the day after her 51st birthday, and then my stepmother passed at age 55 from lung cancer. So that's when my father had the foresight to sit my sister and I down and say, hey, if something happens to me, I'm not sure you're going to know what to do. And he used to give us pieces of paper and information and say, you know, go put that in the file. And as you can imagine, as girls in our 20s, we sort of rolled our eyes and said, yeah, okay, Dad, whatever. But lo and behold, 5 years ago, my also vibrant and healthy father was in a freak accident. And we grabbed this file and went to the hospital and had to make an end-of-life decision, which we had his instructions and wishes for. And then he did not make it, and we had to do the things that everybody has to do with the burial, the services and ceremonies that surrounded the passing, and ultimately wrapping up his personal affairs. And by putting this prototype together, he not only saved us that lifetime of burden on, you know, hey, did we make the right decision? Should we have waited another day or whatnot? But he saved us more than 10,000 tangible dollars and literally hundreds of hours in taking care of his personal affairs by having this information. And so it was such a gift that he gave to us that we wanted to give it back to other people to help protect, whether it's their parents when they pass, or maybe a spouse who's not so sure what's going on in the household, or children if something were to happen to both parents, to make sure that everybody has that preparation.
Tell us about how this system works. I mean, when I saw it online, it kind of looks like one of those accordion files, right? What's in it? What do you have to do to make sure that it's fully utilized?
Yes, so we tried to make it as simple as possible using a lot of our experience in customer service with some of our clients. And we have an instruction manual that walks you step by step through everything that you would need if there was a medical emergency. So it could be an aging issue like Alzheimer's or dementia, or an accident like my father was in. And then through, if somebody passes away, those things that you need to cover immediately, and then the personal affairs. And as you walk through this instructions manual, it actually has you file information in that filing folder that we give you, and it also has you fill out information in the workbook that we give you, and then you put the workbook into the filing folder, and at the end, you have one comprehensive location where your loved ones will know everything that they need, whether it's your medical history, whether it's your doctors, what your wishes are for when you pass, where all of your accounts are, maybe a spare key to your house if something happens in an accident and they need to take care of a pet or get in for some other reason. Now something that's big these days is cryptocurrency. So that
right.
you see your cryptocurrency and your online accounts, literally that they need is in one place, and it gives them a roadmap that walks them through it to make it easier for them.
How long do you tell people this process is going to take? Because I can imagine that's a hurdle for people. Like even once the manual arrives, they think, ugh, when am I ever going to go around to this? Is it 10 hours? Is it 30 hours?
So we did very extensive beta testing because we wanted to know how people would use it. And the majority of our beta testers told us they filled out around 80% of it, that was enough that they felt like got them to the place where they felt like they were well covered, and that it took them 4 to 6 hours. So not as bad as one might think. Obviously, it depends on how prepared you are. You know, if you don't have a will or powers of attorney, it tells you to go to a lawyer and get those taken care of and filed. So there may be a few ancillary activities. But to get all the information together really doesn't take you as long as you think. And by us guiding you through that personal story and breaking it up into these three sections, it makes it a little bit more approachable.
You said in the case of your father, his preparation saved you $10,000. How did you come up with that number?
So interestingly, we found out that end-of-life costs are the third most expensive cost a family incurs in a lifetime between a house and a car. And what he had done is he went through a pre-planning process, which we have included a similar budget in future file. And he said, listen, I don't need the Cadillac of caskets. I don't want flowers at the funeral. I actually don't want two separate services. I just want graveside. I don't want you to do this afterwards. And when we went through the things that we would have purchased had we been left to our own devices and what he actually told us, the differential was more than $10,000.
Wow.
The amount that we did spend, shockingly, was another five figures. It was over $16,000, and we show you that and where it came from. And he had also put life insurance in place, so that helped cover the cost so it didn't come out of his estate. And his estate wasn't large. He was a union electrician. It was a small estate, but it was meaningful to my younger sister, who was living with him at the time, and we had to use that money to cover those costs. She wouldn't have been left.
How do you think about security? I mean, it would seem like there's a real risk that in the wrong hands, the future file could be not the kind of thing you want to let go out of your sight.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why we have two versions. The hard copy version is the one we're currently selling, and we have a software version that is coming in the next couple of months. But it's one of the reasons people actually prefer the hard copy version. We've seen so many issues with people using data online. We've seen it with Facebook. We've seen Equifax being hacked. We've seen in the US the SEC being hacked. So having the paper copy actually gives you more control over who has access to it. And what we tell people is to keep it in a place, you know, like a safe or a lockbox, but to make sure then you've given your loved ones the information on how to access that. So if it's in your house, make sure they have the key to your house or the alarm code and the key to the safe so that they have access to it. If you have a trusted loved one, then you can just give it to them for safekeeping. But obviously every family has different dynamics. And we talk about that in great detail so that you can make the best decision based on your own loved ones and personal dynamics.
Carol, it's a really important topic. I love your new take on it. And thank you for joining us to tell us about it.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Carol Roth is the founder of Future File. Stay with us. Coming up next, what would you give up to be debt-free? Takeout, vacations, the right to vote? Well, look at a new report from Ipsos and MNP on what Canadians would sacrifice to make their debt disappear. And we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with Ellen Roseman. I've written a couple books. You can order them online. The first one is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Yeah. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Would you give up coffee for a whole year if it meant your debt would go away? Would you give up your cell phone, even for a day? Would you give up your right to vote? Some Canadians say they would. According to a new report from Ipsos and MNP, 85% of Canadians said they're willing to make a personal sacrifice to have their debt disappear. Joining us now to talk about the report is Sean Simpson. He is VP of Ipsos Public Affairs, and he joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi there.
85% willing. Here's the thing that mystifies me. If they're willing, why aren't they doing it already? What are they waiting for, an embossed invitation from the Queen to eliminate their debt? Is that what they're waiting for?
Well, the funny thing is around the new year, you hear a lot of advertisements about weight loss, and it says if you could do it yourself, you would have done it already.
Yeah.
I think the same can be said about debt. Lots of people have great notions and aspirations about getting rid of their debt, which a majority live with. But when it comes to following through on taking action, many people just aren't up for the job.
So what are some of the top things people said that they were willing to give up in order to become debt-free?
Well, 31% of Canadians said that they would be willing to eat at home instead of going out for dinner for a year. That's a long time to eat every meal at home. Another 19% say they'd be willing to work 10 hours of overtime per week for a year. And 18% said they would forego 3 years of vacation in order to be debt-free. So those are the top three answers.
Now, did you sort the data according to those who actually were carrying a balance on their credit card and those who weren't? Because as someone who never carries a balance on my card, I would happily walk over hot coals to eliminate debt because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, so we have 31% of the sample who say that they have no debt, and then another 11% who said that they wouldn't be willing to do any of the things we tested. But what that means is that it leaves the vast majority of Canadians with debt and willing to do some of these extraordinary things in order to get rid of it.
How do we prompt them to actually follow through on doing some of these extraordinary things?
Well, I think, first of all, they need to have a realization and understanding that their situation, financial and debt, may not be where it ought to be. And then seeking help, obviously, because as the weight loss commercials go, if you could do it yourself, you would have done it already. So there needs to be somebody to work through it with, much like going to the gym. You say, okay, we are going to do this together, and we're going to not go to Starbucks in the morning and pay $6 for, you know, your Frappuccino, low-fat, you know, whatever it is, almond milk.
Clearly you are not a regular Starbucks consumer, because first of all, that was not an order.
Well, yeah, I struggle. When I do go to Starbucks, even the tall, grande, whatever, I order a small black coffee. That's what I have.
You're so, a Tim's customer. You're a Tim's guy. I could tell.
I'm not, but it's cheaper to order just the regular stuff.
We talk about getting help. 18% of respondents said they would seek professional help from an insolvency trustee to deal with their debt. That number is not all that high. Would they seek other potential resources like a nonprofit credit counselor, a financial advisor?
No, I don't think so, at least not any more significant numbers than what you just said. A lot of people are ashamed of their debt situation, and they don't want to admit it. They don't want to talk about it with anybody, perhaps feeling that they can just get out of it on their own. But the fact that we keep hearing reports in Canada about how people's levels of debt continues to grow, and we're one of the most indebted nations in the world, clearly people aren't able to self-select, and there's a barrier to actually going out and getting that help.
Why do a survey like this? Why would MNP fund these resources if the conclusion is, hey, people are in theory willing, but in practice not willing to do something about their debt?
Well, I mean, the first is that they have a debt practice, and they have licensed insolvency trustees. But The second is that we aren't very good about talking about these things in the public. And I think understanding that there are so many people who are carrying debt, so many people struggling to get out of debt, there's a strength in numbers. And understanding that there are many people out there, and if you know you're not alone, then it's helpful, I think, and maybe encourages more people to take the steps of getting their financial house in order.
We know overall consumer debt is up 3.3% in the last year. What numbers do we have on how prevalent an issue this is? So do we have numbers on how many credit card holders carry an outstanding balance? Clearly, the mortgage one is a bit different because people will be in mortgages for decades. But higher interest consumer debt, like credit cards, do we know how common that is for people to be in a challenging situation on that front?
Yeah. Well, I don't have those stats handy here, but we know from the Bank of Canada, for example, and for some other studies that come out from the Royal Bank and other financial institutions, that it's in the millions. Millions of Canadians carry a credit card debt. Mm-hmm. Millions of Canadians have consumer debt, which is the bad debt, right? Line of credits, credit cards, and they're not paying those off on a monthly basis. And as I mentioned, the Bank of Canada all throughout last year was warning people about debt because interest rates are on the rise. And what this polling for MNP has shown is that a growing proportion of Canadians, it's up in 4 in 10 now, are already beginning to feel the impacts of interest rate increases. It's up 8 points in the last 6 months, and interest rates have barely increased. There's a lot more room for them to increase, but people are already feeling it.
What did you notice generationally? How are millennials, Gen Xers, and boomers different?
Yeah. Well, the millennials, for example, are most likely to say they'd be willing to work overtime or actually list all of their debts online. You know, maybe they're least embarrassed about it, and give up voting and give up their cup of Java. Gen Xers are more likely to say that they're willing to eat at home, even cut up their credit cards or seek professional help. And baby boomers are actually least likely to say they're going to do any of it, largely because they don't have as much consumer debt.
If there was one thing that you could do to get people to take their debt seriously, what would it be?
Lose the sense of embarrassment. And understand that this is a fact of life for many and that there's nothing to be gained by ignoring the issue. Your debt doesn't go away. In fact, if you do nothing about it, it grows because of interest. So if you lose that embarrassment or shame or whatever negative feelings come associated with the debt, then you can just look at it rationally and say, I need to go get help because these people can help me get my situation order, and in 3 years, for example, I won't have any debt and my life will be very different.
Right.
But there's something that prevents people from doing that, and it's irrational negative behaviors.
Well, here we're talking about it today. Sean, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Sean Simpson is VP of Ipsos Public Affairs. He joined us from Kitchener, Ontario. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. It is our series of questions about money. Our answer today is Ellen Roseman. She is a financial journalist and an advocate for consumer rights for the Toronto Star. Ellen, are you ready?
I'm ready.
The first thing that comes to your mind, how would you describe your money personality?
Expansive.
Expansive. What does that mean?
It is that I have lots of ideas about what I want to do with my money. I don't always follow them, but I think big.
People would probably think, now I don't know if this you think this is true. For me, people think I'm frugal inherently because of what I do. Does that label fit for you?
No. I watch my money carefully, yeah. But I feel that if you're too frugal, you're going to have a miserable life and it's like, then you'll binge.
It's yeah.
like eating too little.
And you miss out on the whimsy of life.
Yes.
Too,
so pick your priorities. Try to keep a lot of expenses down, but splurge on the things that are really important to you.
Who was your money mentor growing up?
I guess my father, because he ran a business. He had employees. He didn't talk that much, but we kind of went to the factory a lot. It was a manufacturing operation. And we could see how people loved him, and he seemed to be fairly well off, but without being showy about it.
You have written many books. You teach a course on money. So this is your world. But is there one financial behavior you still work on?
I love to buy books. I just love it. And when I started downloading ebooks, I thought, well, I'm going to save money because they're half the price of hardcover and softcover books. But I still go to bookstores and I still get carried away sometimes and I buy the newest books. And lately the bookstores are discounting too. So our house is full of books. And unlike some collections, books have very little resale value and it really hurts me to get rid of them. So that's my compulsion.
What does financial freedom mean to you?
It means the ability to do what you like without having to worry about a weekly paycheck. And I guess I'm at that stage now because I've worked for many years. I'm not a full-time employee anymore. I'm self-employed and I can just go for projects that I like. And I have enough of a retirement savings nest that I don't have to worry.
Do you think you will ever fully retire?
No.
No. There's your answer. No. Uh-uh.
It's too hard because there's so many people who want me to help them. And it's so easy for me to help them because companies do pay attention when the media get involved. And it's also that I just love the work and I love the intellectual rigor of following all these issues.
What is one money topic you could write about, talk about, focus on every single day and never get tired of it?
I guess it's the human behavior side of things, because we're so interesting. Like the thing that bugs me a lot is that people will come to me and they'll say, did you know about Company X? Look at all these links, and they'll show me all this stuff that the company did. And I said, you were burned, right? And they said, yeah. And when did you figure out all this stuff? Well, afterward, I started realizing.
Ugh.
So it's always that impulse. And companies are so good at appealing to your emotions. They just know how to get you so wound up that you never do any research until afterward. And that by that time, it's too late.
What is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write about or talk about ever again?
HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning.
Really?
Because this has been a topic that's preoccupied my readers for years. It's where the guy comes door to door and he says, can I check out your water heater? And then they promise all kinds of, you know, government grants if they replace your water heater. And the homeowner has no clue who supplied them anyway with the water heater. So they take it off in a perfectly good water heater, put in another one with a 15-year contract, enormous fees, and by that time they're locked in. And every time the government tries to intervene, the provincial government, they bring in new rules that don't really help because the door-to-door people get around them. So we're finally at a point in Ontario where they've banned door-to-door sales for this kind of thing, but they'll just use phone or direct mail or internet or something, and they just keep proliferating. It's just – and I get so tired of water heaters and furnaces. I really do.
Yeah. That's kind of – that's boring stuff there. Are you cynical about corporations or are you merely skeptical about corporations?
I am somewhere between cynical and skeptical. I feel that in the past number of years, they have outsourced so much that the people who answer the phone or the emails don't know what they're talking about. They're given a script, which covers a few circumstances. And they've also reduced the quality is pretty good, but they've reduced the warranty to 1 year. And they have trained people to say, once your 1 year is up, anything that's wrong with the equipment, even if it's a pattern that everybody has, we're not going to cover it because your 1 year is up. And under the law, you're supposed to be selling products that are fit for the purpose for which they're intended. And there's no 1 year in the law. And only in Quebec have they actually made it under the law a legal warranty that you can't do this kind of thing. But elsewhere, we're all trained to accept it. And it makes me crazy.
If you were to snap your fingers and change one behavior, one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
I'd say it would be to stand up for your rights and not be intimidated. And that's not only when something goes wrong, but it's also just negotiating with companies. Mm. Whenever I go out and speak, I talk about how you have to negotiate with your telecom company and try and get a lower rate on your credit card and try and get a better rate on your insurance. And they're kind of terrified of calling up the company and saying, you know, what do I have now? How can I do better? How long have I been a customer of yours? Aren't I loyal to you? Why can't you be loyal to me? Here's some other rates that I found in the marketplace. I want that rate or else I'm going to leave. That's scary stuff. We do it once in a while when we buy a car, but to do it every few months with all our suppliers, that's hard.
Sometimes when our Canadian-ness gets the better of us, we're so busy apologizing when we should be demanding. Ellen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce.
Ellen Roseman on the Moolala Questionnaire. That is our program for today. If you have any financial questions or questions about the show, you can email them to me at ask@moolala.ca. You can also follow me on Twitter at Bruce Sellery. Facebook is Bruce Sellery Moolala. Now, to listen to past episodes of our program, you can either go to our website, moolala.ca, or you can head over to iTunes, where you can also subscribe so the next one just shows up on your device. Thank you very much for joining us today. Take care.